This podcast was recorded on 24 April at 4 p.m. Jakarta time. Things will have changed by the time you hear this. Enjoy the program.
Hi, welcome to Reformasi Dispatch. I'm Erin Cook. I write Dari Mulut Ke Mulut, a near daily newsletter looking at the Southeast Asia region, but especially Indonesia.
And I am Kevin O'Rourke, writer of the Reformasi Weekly Service, analyzing Indonesian politics and policymaking. How you going, Erin?
I'm not bad. How are you?
Yeah, hanging in there.
That's good. I'm looking forward to
you. We talked to you Dan Slater, but we missed you for Dan Slater.
Yeah, I know, hard at work, but I'm very excited for it. So he's got a new paper, Indonesia's High Stakes Handover, in the Journal of Democracy. So I'm very excited to hear all about this one.
Yeah, he's a U.S. academic who's been covering Indonesia closely for a long time now, and he put out a very well-written article summing up Indonesia's electoral process and doing an assessment of the prospects for the Prabowo administration. So we had to do some rescheduling at the last minute. I forgot about how the international dateline works.
That old thing.
So I gave you a wrong time for our start date and start time. So we missed you. But Dan and I had a chat about that and also a little bit about Cambodia because, as you know, his book covered Cambodia a couple of years ago.
Oh, yeah. That was just an amazing chapter, that Cambodia one. I feel like nobody has to write about Cambodia for a few years now. He nailed it.
Yes, well, hopefully something will change there. But his point was that it's becoming even less democratic than it used to be. So kind of disconcerting trends, I guess, from the standpoint of democracy and elections, which are two different things. So if you ask about what's the state of democracy and elections, his answer is, well, which is it? You know, the state of democracy, what's the state of elections?
Okay. Yeah. But what good timing to catch him after the Constitutional Court decision on Monday. So you must have been
We were talking about that too.
With that one.
Yeah, we fit it in a little bit. Yeah, we did touch on that. It's easy because it was in line with expectations and predictions.
Yeah.
The Constitutional Court rejected the presidential election appeals of both Ganjar Pranowo and Anies Baswedan. And by a decision of a majority of the eight justices, so the ninth justice, Anwar Usman, the former chief justice, reclused himself for once as per the orders of the Ethics Council because he is the uncle of one of the candidates, Gibran Rekabumin, the vice president-elect. So it was a eight-member court. So, I mean, it could have been split 4-4, which would have been, I don't know what would have happened then, actually. But in any event, it was a majority against the appeals. Interesting, though, our sound engineer and reporter at large, Stephen Handoko, pointed out to me that all past electoral appeals in the Constitutional Court for presidential elections have elicited unanimous verdicts. This one had dissenting opinions, three, in fact. So,
what does that say to you, that the court is different than it used to be, or this case is so different to past elections?
Yeah, not the court. In fact, I think actually if the exact same merits and arguments had been presented to the first constitutional court that was in office circa 2005-2006, there would probably be a repeat election happening right now. There probably would have been a majority for the appeals, actually, because the major argument was about nepotism, which was a pretty compelling argument because the vice president-elect would not be the vice president-elect were it not for the fact that he circumvented eligibility prohibitions due to the intervention unethically. In four different ways, of his uncle, Anwar Usman, the Chief Justice of the Constitutional Court. So,
yeah, so this is a really interesting sort of aspect of the whole thing, I guess, to me. When I was doing a lot of reporting in the lead up to the election, I was really struck by the amount of supporters for the Prabowo-Gibran ticket who were saying either it is nepotism, but we don't care, we like Gibran, we like Jokowi, or it's not nepotism because Gibran is already a mayor, so he's good at being a public figure. Is that kind of what the court was alluding to, or is it just a whole different perceptions versus legality sort of issue?
That I don't know. I mean, my suspicion would be that ultimately it's cynical because three members of the court had already voted to allow for Gibran to be eligible and to basically insert a loophole into the 2017 election law at the very last minute, last October. So of those five justices this week that ruled the way they did, three of them had already been in Gibran's favor last October. So it was just another two justices that I think were probably unwilling to make the Constitutional Court look bad because it was the court's own fault that Gibran had become eligible. And so it would be a real kind of double standard for the court to say that last time we were wrong, but this time we're right. Plus, the other thing is that the whole significance of Gibran with regard to the election, anyway, was that he was a signifier of the support of the immensely popular Widodo for Prabowo before Gibran was attached to Prabowo's ticket. Not many people knew that Prabowo was Widodo's favorite. Most people, according to polling data, thought that Ganjar was Widodo's favorite. So that attachment of Gibran was basically just a clarion call. So in hypothetically, if the court had said, yeah, that election was done badly and now we have to redo it without Gibran in the race, I think Prabowo would still end up winning 58% because everybody knows now that Prabowo is the favorite of Widodo, regardless of whether Gibran is there or not.
Yeah, okay, that's interesting. So it really is all about Jokowi at the end of the day. For a lot of these voters.
I think so. Yep. Yeah, he's in a category of his own nowadays, right or wrong, or for better or worse. Yeah. Mm. And so I think the significant thing about this verdict was not the verdict in and of itself, actually, but the reactions specifically from PDIP, which is very much looking like it's going to be a dedicated long-term opposition party.
Yes. And PDIP hasn't really been in that spot for a long time.
Well, they've done it more than most parties, actually. But you're right. Yeah, it's been 10 years, which for you is a long time. Yeah. For me, it's like yesterday. Yeah. I mean, kind of depends on your perspective. But they managed to stay in the opposition for all 10 years of the Udiono era. And so this is good news if you're a political analyst, because there's going to be politics to analyze. Whereas if everybody's in the government, then there's nothing to analyze. But it's, you know, I mean,
that's it. And that was one of the big criticisms of the Jokowi years, that he got everybody into the tent and then there was no dissent or criticism at all.
Right. Yeah.
But do you see this good news for the next 5 years? It could be a bit more dynamic.
Yes. Yes. To answer in a way that is non-facetious for once. My answer is that it's healthy for democracy and for politics. Yeah, it provides for debate and discourse and rivalry and so on. Still remains to be seen, though, if PDIP is going to be able to stick to its resolve on this point, because they really are vulnerable in a lot of ways and they could potentially come under immense pressure to conform and suborn themselves to the Prabowo administration, or even in the shorter term, the Widodo administration. So, you know, remains to be seen for sure. In particular, as we've talked about, there's the propensity for the Widodo administration to benefit from legal system investigations of political party figures and opponents and to steer politics that way. And Megawati's son-in-law, Happy Hepsoro, is a pretty major business figure with lots of interest and therefore lots of vulnerabilities to investigations, one of which has already pertained to one of his 99% owned companies in the base transceiver station scandal, where the head of the company is in jail. It's just Rizal. So Happy Hepsoro is kind of on the front line there. And so it's remarkably bold for PDIP to take the stance that it took, which is it issued an open letter signed by the Secretary General, Hasto Cristianto, who's very close to Megawati, and Megawati's son, Prananda Prabowo, and also signed by Bambang Urianto, who's a senior party figure who's the closest aide to Puan Maharani. So basically, with the signatures of Hasto and Urianto, it really signifies the unity of the entire PDIP leadership, which has spanned these two extremes. Yeah. So, and the letter itself.
That's interesting that you say that. Yeah. Last week you mentioned that there seemed to be a bit of a split between Puan and Hasto's camp within the party and where PDIP should be heading next. It sounds like this is, now that the decision's come down, that's been resolved, at least for now.
Yeah, at least on this one piece of paper that I saw. Yeah, that's what remarkable. That was pretty remarkable. So that was why this was a bit unanticipated, because they had these diverging camps, and Puan Maharani had attended that Eid al-Fitr celebration with Rosan Ruslani of Prabowo's camp a couple weeks ago. But now this letter came out, and the letter really denounces the Widodo administration roundly for nepotism and manipulation and unfair.
That's a bit rich with Puan's signature on there, or Puan's aide signature on there.
Exactly, for nepotism, right? I mean, given that, she is the daughter of the
party. Oh, and her son.
Well, I get it. That's a good point. Maybe I should reread the letter. Maybe it didn't really emphasize nepotism. I think it mentioned the word, though, but cheating is the word that it repeated over and over again. Yeah, but it was just very strongly
worded. That's true. And what happened there is a whole other level to sort of run-of-the-mill nepotism that we see all the time.
Yeah. This letter, they did, the PDIP letter affirmed that the party would abide by the decision of the Constitutional Court. So this is not like a denunciation of the system. It's a denunciation of the Widodo administration.
How valuable do you think that is? I know that after 2014 and the 2019 MK sort of decisions, it got quite scary for a while there, a few days in Jakarta with lots of riots and that sort of thing. The supporters of the losing two candidates didn't really strike me as the type of guys to
set
Tamarind on fire.
Yeah.
But is this kind of a show that, you know, everybody's all on board and everything's going to be safe and sound?
For the democratic system, actually, yes, for now, until there's another serious incursion, such as cancellation of regional head elections, potentially, or a hasty or contentious amendment of the Constitution to alter the electoral system, then there could and probably will be some serious protest activity and potentially even instability. But for now, no, everybody's on board. And in fact, Prabowo's got remarkable popular support. It's a strong electoral mandate of 58%. Now, given that he won because of the endorsement of Widodo, who has a popularity of 80%, you can argue that, well, Prabowo's support is actually pretty weak. it's not 80, but at the end of the day, it's 58% in a three-way race.
Yeah, that's it. Leaders around the world would give anything for a margin like that. That's amazing.
Yeah.
So we're seeing more people start jumping on over to his side. I know that there's PKB talk, but I don't know.
There's going to be some realignment happening now. So since the outcome has been confirmed by the court, it's the appropriate time for parties to determine their alignment, and also for certain political figures to decide whether they're going to run for regional head or not, in particular Anies Baswedan for governor. And there's a lot of talk about Anies Baswedan not running for governor of Jakarta.
What an interesting time. So you've got sort of the parties trying to pick up some treats in the cabinet perhaps, but also some potential future stars looking at regional spots.
Yeah.
And it's a tough balance for a lot of these parties.
Yeah, and as political analysts, the good thing is that we can milk this for the next 6 months, because it's going to be a very slow process. The parties aren't going to make up their mind until they get confirmation about how many cabinet seats they're going to get in return, and that's not going to be known for sure until inauguration day. And then the regional head elections only happen in November, so the nominations there would be happening, probably September or August, I think, would be the nomination period. So there's still a lot of time for maneuvering.
Yeah, a lot of time for gossip for the next few months. That's good.
Yeah, and then the other development to note here is that PDIP confirmed that Joko Widodo is no longer a party member, nor is Gibran Rakabuming.
So they're officially out.
And then it comes down to the age old question of in Indonesia of who's doing what to whom, who's doing what to whom, and is it passive or active? And so the other question to the PDIP official was, so you kicked Widodo out? And I'm like, no, we didn't kick him out. He invalidated his membership himself. So it was the PDIP is portraying themselves as being passive, but and that it was Widodo who disqualified himself by backing Prabowo, basically.
Yeah, I think they might have an argument there.
But so anyway, that's happened, I think, as a way to help insulate PDIP against the possibility of Widodo taking over the party from the Sukarno family.
Mm. Yeah. Oh, gosh. Because that's something that's been talked about ever since Gibran got sort of tapped. Do you think there is or has been a genuine possibility that could happen? Because that would be an astronomical shift.
Yeah, it would be astronomical for sure.
Like,
yeah,
to have Megawati pushed out, let alone Jokowi coming in.
Right. Well, ordinarily, I would say no, for a whole bunch of reasons. One is that Megawati is just so strong, and she's accumulated hardcore personal loyalists all around her throughout the party. And the party really does have a pretty vibrant ideology, or maybe not vibrant, but heavy-duty ideology, for lack of a better phrase, regarding extolling Sukarno and upholding him as an icon. So these are things that make the party resilient vis-a-vis any pressures. And then another factor is that Prabowo will probably not want PDIP to be under Widodo, because he's not as popular as Widodo. And PDIP under Widodo would be a formidable entity to potentially rival Prabowo. So Prabowo would be much happier either have PDIP in the opposition, or much better would be PDIP under somebody who's personally loyal to Prabowo. But having said all that, it is a possibility, just because Widodo may have the ability to destabilize PDIP to such an extent that he could proclaim himself party chair, potentially, hypothetically, and get away with it before leaving office in October.
Oh, God. Okay. So just wait and see on that one as well.
Yeah, it's a little bit speculative, but it is playing out, I think, because there's this corruption case about RBT. It's Robert Bono Susatya. And this was something I was writing about last week. And it seems like it's just kind of, in a way, a run-of-the-mill criminal case involving illegality by somebody who owns a tin mining company. But once you start looking beneath the surface, it's being done by the Attorney General's office, Burhanuddin, reputedly at the behest of the president. And the target of the investigation have been these people named Harry Moise and his partner Sandra Dewi. And they're just sort of the public face of a company which has the initials RBT, which is owned by a guy whose initials are RBT, Satya. And that's the tin mining company, and that's just one part of his operations. And he has had an association in the past with the current intelligence agency chief, the retired police general Budi Gunawan, who is the confidant of Megawati. So you can go up and up the scale here, and it's potentially something that could lead to the destabilization of PDIP.
Which is really interesting, because that wouldn't be the first time we've seen these sort of anti-corruption cases really mess with a party structure.
Sure, yes. So Satya Novanto. The KPK brought down Satya Novanto's gold card chair 8 years ago, and that really made a huge difference to politics today.
Yeah. Wow. Okay. So we may be seeing another Secha show.
Yeah, it's still speculative to be sure, but that's definitely like a corruption case which is out of the ordinary. Interesting though that this guy RBT avoided arrest. He underwent interrogation for 13 hours in early April, but did not become a suspect. So
there might not be too much in it.
Yeah, this effort may have failed already. Yeah, it may have already failed. Yeah, it's going to depend on how much political resolve there is to pursue him. And there's various kind of spurious NGOs getting involved in denouncing RBT. So it seems like it's a concerted campaign underway. And then another thing too, it's funny, the wrinkle about this is that tin mining all happens in one place, which is the island of Banka, and the dominant player is the state tin mining company, Tima. But then among all the other players, RBT is one of the biggest, but the one that's been expanding the most and has the most ambitions is part of the Arsari group owned by Hashim Jojo Hadikasumo, the brother of the president-elect. So they're the ones who stand to benefit from the removal of RBT.
It might be time to start getting all the news articles on the wall and putting it together with strings, I think.
Yeah, that's right. Whiteboard time. Yeah, so I think that's about all we got for this episode. And coming up next, we'll have interview with Professor Dan Slater from the University of Michigan about his article in the Journal of Democracy. Thanks, Aaron.
Thank you so much for having me, and I'm really looking forward to this one with Dan. I'll see you next week.
All right. See you, Aaron. Bye-bye. Professor Dan Slater, how are you?
I'm doing well, Kevin. Nice to be with you again.
Yeah, great to have you back. Dan Slater is the James Orrin Murfin Professor of Political Science and the Director of the Center for Emerging Democracies at the International Institute at the University of Michigan. And you've got a new article, Indonesia's High Stakes Handover, and really glad to be able to discuss that with you. This is from the Project Muse and the Journal of Democracy and the April edition. I'm going to jump right into it. So a quote you have is that the man who has spent the past three decades doing more than anyone to deny Indonesians the right to elect their leaders has now been elected Indonesia's leader. And you close off the article at the end by saying that Indonesian democracy has never been headed by a man like Prabowo Subianto. How should outsiders be thinking about Prabowo based on his record?
Well, hopefully with great wariness. I think that he's certainly been going over an image makeover over the past year or so. But I think that the track record is what the track record is, and that includes the leading role he played in the atrocities of the late Suharto years, and it's included the role he's played in being kind of the leading election denier over the past decade, the leading kind of stirrer up of intolerant sentiments, kind of basically playing nice with some of the least nice elements of political Islam in Indonesia, you know, questioning the current president's religion and religiosity. So I think it's pretty clear that he's a person who'll do whatever it takes to get to the pinnacle. And then that doesn't give me a lot of confidence of how he'll behave once he gets to the pinnacle. But, you know, the wager has been struck. The current president Jokowi has, you know, basically placed his bets on Prabowo. The people have endorsed that handover, and so now we'll see if the institutions of Indonesian democracy can constrain him. We'll see if his, you know, appetites for power lead him to the kind of abusiveness that we see, you know, elected chief executives, you know, engaging in all over the world, like, you know, in recent times.
Okay, well, there's plenty to dig into here. Right, that's interesting, Dan. So you mentioned the quality of democracy and the quality of Indonesia's elections, and that was something that came up in your article. How does that stand now in Indonesia in your mind? How is democracy faring in light of this latest national election?
So there's how democracy is faring, and there's how elections are faring, and those aren't always the same thing. What we see around most of the world lately is that, you know, election quality is staying pretty good, but you're seeing elected leaders just use a lot more, you know, using the powers of their executive office to go after their opponents, to go after diversity, go after vulnerable groups, to go after opposition groups. So even when elections stay pretty free and fair, sometimes democracy can really go downhill, and that's been in the case in places like India, Turkey, and the like, even I think Hungary, it's really not the elections that isn't the big problem. So in that respect, Indonesia, it's worrisome that this time around, actually, it does seem like we had the least free and fair elections that we've had, certainly at the presidential level. And so there, we just today, in fact, on the day we're recording, the Indonesian High Court basically rejected 5-3 the suit by the opposition candidates, the losing candidates in the election, to redo the vote or toss out the result. And so I think that's going to send some mixed signals about, how high quality the elections were. The fact that the losing candidates contested the election, I think, again, there's good and bad in that. I think there's certainly causes for concern, but you also don't want to entirely undermine people's sense that, in elections is a way of choosing leaders. This was, I think, a legitimate result. It's pretty clear from the opinion polls beforehand that Prabowo was, he was the choice of about, 60% of the people, and that's about what he got. So I think the elections, they delivered the will of the people, but there was certainly too much maneuvering, too much, in terms of intimidation, too much pressure, too much, sort of constitutional skullduggery being used by the incumbent president to make these elections as free and fair as the previous presidential elections have been.
Right. And this is not a case where there's an angry electorate which has opted for a demagogic candidate out of frustration with the incumbent, but quite the opposite. So is it fair to say that Prabowo has a popular mandate, and that's going to be something that helps him in the initial stages?
I don't think he's got a lot of a popular mandate, to be honest. I think Jokowi has a popular mandate. And when Jokowi decided to throw his weight behind Prabowo, that's what made all the polls switch. I say in the article, the most important reason Prabowo is president is that Jokowi decided he wanted him to be president. If he had, backed the candidate from his own party, Ganjar Pranowo, throughout, I don't think there's much doubt that Ganjar would have won. And so I think this is something where, Prabowo has essentially borrowed the popularity of Jokowi. He's somewhat popular himself. But the popularity of Jokowi is the current president is what got him over the top. And so, I think it's a pretty weak mandate. There wasn't a lot in terms of issues or of, any real policy mandate coming out of the election. It was pretty much an image-oriented election, which is, not unique to Indonesia. That's true in a lot of elections in a lot of places nowadays. But I would say, I try to make the case in the article, we should be thinking this is the opposite of a honeymoon, because when you give a newly elected leader a honeymoon, that kind of lets them, do whatever they want. Whereas in reality, when leaders are newly elected, that's when they're probably more likely to think, well, the people are behind me. I can do no wrong. Nobody can touch me. I am democracy. If you get in my way, you're against democracy. So therefore, I'll do whatever I want. So I think I'm really hoping that the international community and that Indonesian civil society and other political parties and really the whole set of actors with a stake in Indonesian democracy are going to be very, very wary at this point and really ready from day one, even before day one, to constrain the Prabowo presidency from doing more damage to democracy in Indonesia than has already been done, and kind of accelerating the kind of erosion that we've seen, particularly under the last 5 years with the presidency of Jokowi.
Yeah, I was glad to see you pointed out that continuity amid deterioration equals deterioration.
Right.
Even though there's quite a lot of optimism, which I think is misplaced, about the positive aspects of Widodo's tenure undergoing continuation.
Yeah. Well, I think I would just say, I think Indonesians are basically, they're pretty happy, with how things are going. They're happy with his approach to the economy, above all else. I mean, Jokowi is obsessed with the economy, and when the leader's obsessed with the economy, the voters tend to be focused on the same thing. Be focused on things that presidents ignore, right?
But you point out that Prabowo is not someone who necessarily shares that.
Yeah, well, I think that, again, the way I see this is the people have basically voted in favor of this peace pact. between Jokowi and Prabowo. And, you know, in the mid 2010s, you know, things were looking pretty polarizing, things were looking possibly destabilizing. And, you know, after, you know, Jokowi, you know, thumps Prabowo a second time in the 2019 election, he basically offers him the olive branch, he offers him the defense ministry. And he's basically had, you know, Prabowo in his, you know, in his paw ever since then. And so I think people kind of like this arrangement. They like the fact that the heated rhetoric and the, you know, the risks of instability from 5 years ago now seem to be in the past. And so, again, this is kind of an endorsement of that whole strategy of Jokowi to kind of bring Prabowo into the fold so he couldn't make more mischief, or wouldn't make more mischief, at least during Jokowi's second term. Whether he'll make mischief during Prabowo's own first term is a very different question, I think.
But is that a misperception, and is there going to be a sense of disappointment or dismay among the electorate sooner or later, you think?
Well, we'll see what happens, of course. I think that Prabowo is not going to be very invested in, you know, changing the economic trajectory of the country. So, you know, and the Indonesian economy is doing well largely because of, you know, resource exports and, you know, incoming investments. So it doesn't take a whole lot of, you know, really brilliant economic management to keep the Indonesian economy, you know, chugging along and churning at a pretty good pace. So I think at this point, you know, the Indonesian bureaucracy and, you know, local government are basically geared toward a kind of delivery of economic development that, you know, that certainly still serves the interest of the super wealthy in Indonesia. That's always true, and that's no less true now. But I think there is just a way in which, since Jokowi has been president, that the, you know, the economy is more responsive, you know, that people have higher expectations for, you know, what is going to be delivered. And I think those expectations will stay high. And I think Prabowo is going to be, you know, he will probably be motivated to keep that happening. And it's going to happen more or less on autopilot. I don't think that's something he needs to do anything very much. So in that respect, I think we're not headed for some immediate disappointment or some huge change of trajectory necessarily. I think we could see this acceleration of democratic erosion. Again, you know, that may or may not lead to, you know, a lot of pushback from Indonesian civil society, in part because, you know, Jokowi had already shown that he could kind of put Indonesian civil society in its place, and, you know, criminalize protest more than his predecessors had. And so it's really an open question whether, you know, if Prabowo accelerates this erosion, as I expect he will, you know, what's the pushback going to be like, and are there going to be parties in opposition to cater to that sentiment, or is everybody going to be kind of wrapped into the Prabowo government and therefore just perfectly happy with whatever he does?
Yeah, my apprehension is about not just the democratic erosion, but also in terms of erratic policymaking, or policymaking becoming even more erratic. Mm-hmm. And most importantly, most fundamentally for Indonesia, is governance standards. So and if those even worsen even further, then that does start to jeopardize economic conditions. What's your feeling about that? And how do you look at the prospects for governance?
Yeah, fair enough. You know, it's a good point. I think that, you know, again, I think that if Prabowo builds a government where there's really no opposition, and if, you know, again, natural resource exports and foreign investment are, you know, really kind of maintaining their pace, that there might be very, very little interest in, you know, sort of paying any attention to institutional reform. I think that the real weakening of the Anti-Corruption Commission, the KPK, is also really worrisome in this regard. So I think you're right. I think there is a real prospect that you could see, you know, when you have a president in office who's less concerned, you know, obsessed like Jokowi was with just the performance of the economy, that you could see, you know, essentially the control weaken. Prabowo is going to likely be focused on things like his own image, his own international standing, you know, trying to play a bigger role on the international stage. You know, he'll, I think, be much more comfortable with that than Jokowi ever was. And so, yeah, I think, you know, while the cat is away, the mice can play. And so I think that, you know, the kind of somewhat of a tight ship, I would say, Jokowi has run compared to his predecessors could indeed loosen up. I think that's a fair critique and a fair worry that I hadn't really focused on myself. But I definitely take your point.
Yeah. Yeah, I appreciate the reference to Tom and Jerry too, you know, with a cats and the mice. That's
Sure. It's not a full podcast without one, you know.
Yeah, something that crops up in the Indonesian media. They always are making references to Tom and Jerry and the cops and robbers. I love it. What's at issue, though, is that the weakening of the KPK is potentially worse than that. It's an entity that could become an instrument of torture if it suffers abuse. Is that something that concerns you as well, or is that something to be watchful
no,
for?
No, for sure. Well, I mean, so I think this is something where, you know, I think one form of pushback I've gotten from the piece, because what I try to argue is that, you know, so I think there's sort of a pretty defeatist view of Indonesian democracy right now, and there's kind of a complacent view. And I think the defeatist view is that, well, Jokowi's already basically wrecked the place, and you know, in terms of democracy, right? And so you didn't need, you know, some kind of strong man or anti-system guy like Prabowo to wreck democracy, because Jokowi just did it himself, you know? So that's sort of one view. And another view is that, well, I mean, you know, lots of people have stake in this thing continuing. You know, Prabowo is likely to meet resistance if he tries to change too much. And institutions are, you know, while not, you know, maybe not real juggernauts, you know, Indonesian democratic institutions, you know, have some real life in them, and that they should be able to withstand a Prabowo presidency. So my view is that both of those positions kind of miss something, which is that I think, you know, there's still a lot of quality in Indonesian democracy, but that's what makes the danger so great. So I think this, you know, as I say, it's high stakes. And the KPK is at the heart of this. So I think one perspective, and again, the pushback I've received, is to say, well, the KPK is already gone. It's already being used against political opponents. It's already flipped. It's already flipped from, you know, one of the, you know, post-colonial world's most impressive examples of an anti-corruption commission that actually checked, you know, real corrupt behavior, to being, you know, a weaponized tool of the executive. And again, I take that point. I think that it's possible that we've already turned, you know, kind of turned a corner or crossed a Rubicon on that one. But again, I sort of tend to think that, you know, the institution is there. It's got this, you know, infrastructure to it. It has, you know, some muscle memory such that, you know, again, I think most countries would anti-corruption activists would love to have an institution like that, even if it's been kind of hijacked in recent years. So, again, I think that, you know, things have certainly gotten worse, and they could get, but I think they can get a lot more worse, which is not a word, but they could get even worse than worse. What's the word for that? Again, acceleration of erosion is what I keep calling it, but yeah, so bad. So getting worse, and yeah, that could pace of that could definitely increase. And the KPK is definitely a place to be, you know, to be looking, because it's really one of the most important, you know, institutions Indonesia has to try to keep, you know, democracy on track, governance, as you emphasized, on track. You know, it's vital.
Right. Have you seen a change in the relations between the executive and the legislature, between the president and parties? For so many years, the national elites in the various fragmented parties were able to exert some kind of check, and I guess sometimes that's called cartelization, maybe, but circling the wagons is one expression. Has that changed under Widodo with the KPK and also the AGO pressuring parties, such that Parliament is veering more towards a rubber stamp entity at the moment?
No, I think there has been a change, but the change is that Jokowi knew how to run a cartel in a way that made him stronger and made his partners weaker. Whereas SBY, prior president, and Megawati, you know, did not know how to do that. And that was not in their nature. They were definitely constrained by the kind of the demands of, you know, and the constraints of the cartel. But for Jokowi, what he realized is that, well, if you have a lot of partners, they're all weak, and you can play them off against each other. And you're actually stronger. You're in a stronger position if you have a lot of partners than if you have very few. So Jokowi really used, he built up a party cartel like his predecessors did, but he just knew how to run it and knew how to use it in a way to enhance his own power, weaken Parliament, weaken these other parties. And then the question becomes, well, is this kind of, you know, again, Prabowo is not someone with executive experience. I mean, SBY, Mega, these people didn't have executive experience. You know, Jokowi had been a chief executive before. He had a better idea of how to be a chief executive. And so whether or not Prabowo can, you know, pull off the same feat and be as strong of a president as Jokowi was. And again, part of that is backed up by those poll ratings. I mean, when you're just polling 80% day in and day out, you know, you can stand a little taller in these confrontations. You know, you've got something that nobody else in the country has. And, you know, Prabowo doesn't necessarily have anything like that. So I guess I would say it's going to be, Prabowo will certainly try to bring every single party into his government. That's going to be a negotiation. That's going to go on probably, you know, for months. And we'll see whether, I think, particularly, you know, particularly whether NASDEM and particularly whether PDIP stay out. And if they do, we're going to have, you know, definitely a stronger check. So the first thing is, does he bring them in or not? What are the terms of that kind of negotiation? And then the question is going to be, well, is Prabowo going to be able to kind of get his way, or is he going to kind of, you know, turn things over? And I think in some ways, you know, he's, you know, my sense is he kind of relishes his newfound popularity. And I think he, you know, he might be disinclined to stir things up too much in some ways. So I think he'll probably give his partners most of what they want. So I think in that way, we could be returning to something where, you know, again, power is a little more widely shared, but not in a way that's, you know, good for democracy so much, but it's just essentially means that, you know, partners can take what they want. And because one thing you can offer your partner is, you know, basically immunity from prosecution or investigations. You know, the fact that you're sharing widely doesn't mean you're doing it in a way that's good for accountability or democracy. So that kind of elite inside self-dealing, I think, will be back with a vengeance. And whether the president is the one in the dominant position or whether, you know, these other parties and parliament are going to reassert themselves is going to be a big, big question as we move into this new presidency.
Yeah, well, I want to come back to Widodo later, but on this topic, Prabowo managing politics, what would you anticipate in the event of a scenario of a downturn in, let's say, the international economy? So with slower growth, slower exports, what we're seeing right now is the rupiah weakening quite a lot, down to 16,200 already yesterday. And so higher inflation and then a disgruntled electorate. Dynamics do you see from a Prabowo administration and those circumstances?
Well, I'd be very concerned. You know, I think that it's one thing to be magnanimous or the, you know, the cuddly grandpa when you're popular and you're getting what you want. But it's another thing when people are turning against you and if public opinion is turning against him and if, you know, there's protests and, you know, again, I would not have a lot of faith in his forbearance in the face of, you know, real opposition, either at the elite level or at the popular level. So I think, you know, this is one of these situations where, you know, you have the best thing for, you know, the best thing for Indonesia is for Indonesia to do well, right? If the economy is doing well, and that's going to probably lead to less, you know, less chance of a political crisis or some kind of big confrontation between Prabowo and his opponents. So then maybe things can be on something kind of like autopilot, you know, for the next 5 years in a way that is not optimal, but it's also not, you know, again, that acceleration that I'm worried about, that accelerated erosion might not happen as quickly as I fear.
And will Widodo become, ironically, the biggest proponent of a free press if that's his only way of exerting influence in politics after 20 October?
I suspect that won't be how he plays his hand. No, I think he'll have other ways, other networks, other devices for trying to get his views across. So, don't think that will ever be a primary issue for Jokowi.
Well, how do you see their alliance panning out?
Well, he's obviously, you know, we've got Jokowi's son is the vice president. So, you know, the political bromance between Jokowi and Prabowo was sort of consummated in this, you know, full scale, you know, familial marriage, if you will. The vice presidency in Indonesia has always been a very weak position. I've never really understood why people seem to want it so much. So I don't think it necessarily means a lot, you know, other than a kind of initial signal of that commonality. And I helped, you know, it did sort of cement the peace pact and, you know, gave people who love Jokowi reason to vote for Prabowo. So it served that purpose. You know, going forward, I think that Jokowi is going to want to make sure Prabowo doesn't go too far from the script in terms of the economy in particular. And so, again, we'll just see if Prabowo becomes incentivized to do so. Or, I mean, my sense is that this is not going to be something where Jokowi is going to play this enormous role or be this hugely important figure. You look at, you know, someone like Duterte in the Philippines, you know, as soon as he steps aside, he's maybe not an irrelevance, but, you know, all that popularity doesn't really mean very much when you're not in office. And so the potential is certainly there for Prabowo to slip the chain and not feel like he's got to remain beholden to Jokowi. But again, Prabowo doesn't really have the popularity Jokowi has. So the smart play for Prabowo, if he wants a pretty stable, you know, pretty easygoing presidency, one where he's riding high in the saddle, as it were, I think that him taking advice from Jokowi and from Jokowi's people and trying to essentially govern in a way that's Jokowi's third term is not a bad play.
Right. So it comes down to what Prabowo decides himself in terms of how much he wants to accommodate Widodo.
Yeah. And what he wants to accomplish. Does he have an agenda that, again, wouldn't have really come through when he was just sort of just basically making a lot of anodyne statements during the campaign, you know, just going to unite all Indonesians and continuity and, you know, nothing really objectionable. And so, you know, it's really possible that persists. You know, he's going to get in the habit of, in this routine of just sort of being a kind of mild-mannered unifier, at least, you know, within, and then maybe save some of his thunder for the international stage. You know, that could be what he does.
Okay. Yeah. Internationally, how do you see Prabowo's worldview?
Well, I mean, I think he's, you know, he sent a pretty clear signal from the get-go, you know, his first overseas trip as president-elect, you know, still as defense minister. So he went to China first, and then he went to Japan and popped by Malaysia on the way back to Indonesia. But I think, you know, going to China and Japan shows he knows where the big powers in East Asia are. He knows that they both have enormous economic interests and stakes in Indonesia. And he's going to do everything he can to keep them both, you know, very actively involved, as well as the United States, as well as Australia and the like. And so, yeah, I suppose there are scenarios in which human rights criticisms, or there could be, you know, conditions under which he could pull something of a Duterte and try to, you know, sort of say to lean more toward China, say, and become, you know, a little bit more anti-American in his rhetoric and maybe with some of his, you know, choices of seeking out investment partners. That's not impossible, but the pressure on any Indonesian president just to try to maintain, you know, a nice broad portfolio of external dependencies is just kind of an overwhelming structural necessity, if you will. So I think that this is an area where there might be difference in style, but in substance, it's hard to imagine what would push Prabowo to really change that kind of, you know, equidistance from all the world's major powers and try to make sure that the United States, China, Japan, and the European Union, et cetera, are all, you know, on friendly terms with and, you know, openly trading with and investing with Indonesia, because, you know, obviously the Indonesian economy is just incredibly, you know, interdependent. It can't stand alone. It needs these external partners. So I would think that, you know, again, it's one of these cases where, you know, personality could, you know, go against the grain, and maybe he will try to, you know, strike more of a Mahathir style or a Duterte style champion of the third world kind of, he might do that, but you know, the economic cost of doing so could be pretty steep. And it's not obvious to me that that's how he's going to want to go about it. I think he might prefer to be a statesman and be pretty happy that America's letting him back in the country again. And, you know, he might very well just ride with that.
There was a lot of rhetoric in his campaign speeches this year, as in past elections, about autarky, import substitution, vindictiveness towards Europe, in particular trade spats. So does that reflect a different set of priorities from Indonesia's past few presidents, and that have implications then for how Indonesia might position itself?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's probably, I like where you're headed with this. I think you're right. I think it's worth thinking of this in terms of priorities, right? So for Jacobi, the priority was always just development, development, development. And oh, by the way, let's get some development while we're doing development, right? It was really it. And not a lot of concern for international prestige and these kinds of things. Just everything's about development. But in Prabowo's case, I think he's not obsessed with development. That's not what he spent his career trying to, trying to bring about. And so, yeah, I suppose it's true that if trade spats arise and we are seeing, a move toward more, industrial policy in the United States, for instance, I think we're going to be seeing more of it in Europe. The impending influx of Chinese imports in particular is going to make it pretty hard for the world's wealthiest countries to just maintain as open of a trade policy as they have in recent decades. And Indonesia could get sucked up in that. And if so, the fact that Prabowo is probably equally, if not more, interested in his prestige, Indonesia's prestige, the kind of national greatness, that he might trade off some pride for some money. He might be willing to do the prideful thing if it hurts the Indonesian economy a little bit more than someone like Jokowi would. So yeah, I think that he certainly has an appetite for confrontation and a capacity for confrontation and for saber rattling and chest thumping and whatever that is very different from any of his predecessors, really. SBY, Jokowi were both, certainly much more low key people who were not looking for confrontation. So yeah, I think you could see. It wouldn't surprise me if there was, at least again, at the level of rhetoric, maybe not the level of substance, but at least at the level of rhetoric, kind of some more thunderous, cries coming out of Jakarta. It's not going to be the Sukarno years, but he might try to get to, wake up those echoes a little bit, when controversies arise and allow him to position himself. And again, as kind of a champion of the third world and a champion of Indonesia against former colonizers and that kind of thing. That's clearly a rhetoric he's very comfortable dabbling in.
Yeah, I find it interesting to draw comparisons and contrasts with some of the earlier Indonesian presidents, Sukarno and Suharto. Mm-hmm. Prabowo looks and acts and dresses like Sukarno, but he's the son-in-law of Suharto and he cares about the military like Suharto. So
yeah, that's for sure. That is for sure. Yeah. And I think the military is another big worry spot here. The military is not playing the kind of role in Indonesia that it does in Thailand or Myanmar, certainly, but it does play a big role. And Prabowo does want to bring back, I think, the territorial system in full force. And again, I think that even the partial demilitarization of politics that we've had in the past 25 years is likely to be reversed in a pretty serious way. And so, that's something where I think really like what's most likely to be worse in 5 years than now, that's probably right about the top of the list, I would say.
All right. Yes. It's going to be a few things to look at. The November elections coming up for regional heads is a crucial one, as you point out, in high stakes election. Your article. The appointments as well, not just for the cabinet, but for the military, because Widodo has a strong personal loyalist in key military posts, including the army chief is the son-in-law of Luhut. So those are going to be positions that's going to take some time for Prabowo to unwind. So that'll be something to look for, I guess.
Yeah, or he might not. I mean, I think, again, there are a lot of positions and, generally speaking, Indonesian elites, it's probably their core competency is carving up the pie in a way that no one gets too left out. And so I suspect that it shouldn't be too hard for Prabowo to keep Jokowi on board and make him happy by keeping certain people in the cabinet, in leading government positions. But then on the other hand, find ways to reward his own folks as well. So, again, that's usually not, it takes a lot of negotiating. It's a slow process. It's a contentious process, but usually they manage to find a way to get these deals done and reach a settlement where, no one has to give up too many pounds of flesh.
Yeah. I hope that Prabowo is going to be able to manage that smoothly with some subtlety rather than being sort of like a bull that carries his own China shop around with him everywhere he goes.
Right. Right.
Well, I want to turn just at the end here for a moment to Cambodia, just because that's something that you've also been writing on. And our co-host, Aaron Cook, likes to follow that and cover it. She was unfortunately unable to join us on this interview today because of a conflict, but she really appreciated that article that you wrote as being something very helpful and something that sheds light on a country that gets too little coverage, I think. So what's been going on there lately, and what's kind of the latest outlook in Cambodia from your perspective?
Well, I think the thing in Cambodia is that you've got this, you know, kind of dynastic, you know, system that's sort of consolidating itself now. So with Hun Sen sort of passing the torch to his son at a time when his son is still pretty young and when Hun Sen is still, as far as I can tell, like pretty healthy and pretty active. And so this is one way that former socialist regimes do things. They, you know, they turn from kind of party rule toward more personal rule. But I think that it's telling that Cambodia is kind of a different category than the rest of the most of the rest of the region, because it's really just gone from being a kind of, you know, electoral authoritarian regime, competitive authoritarian regime, very much like, you know, say Malaysia or Singapore or, you know, even Thailand for most of the past 20 years, to really becoming a pretty substantially closed regime. And in that respect, it's sort of, and the argument that Joseph Wong and I make in our book is that, you know, Cambodia is sort of this, you know, again, kind of a cluster of countries, more like China and Vietnam than like, you know, again, Malaysia, Singapore, you know, places it was being compared to as these electoral authoritarian, you know, competitive authoritarian regimes when the opposition was quite strong. And, you know, Cambodia has a really robust civil society. It has since the 90s. So it's going to be hard to keep that in check entirely. But in terms of the party system, in terms of elections, you know, it's really kind of restoring the one party rule of, you know, honestly, like of like the Cold War era. It's really back to a pretty serious past in Cambodia right now. And certainly the fact that Cambodia can rely on Chinese support and Chinese sponsorship, no matter what it does, has really just kind of allowed it to just really shut down shop. And what was a really, you know, pretty vibrant, pretty competitive, again, certainly not fair. It was skewed. It was certainly authoritarian. But again, a la Malaysia, you know, 10, 15 years ago, it looked more like Malaysia, being a pretty competitive place. Opposition was strong. Civil society was active. There were popular opposition politicians. And now it looks more like it's going more the way of a Vietnam or a China. So I think you have to understand these countries' history. You know, understand the deep, you know, historic roots of these regimes, even in the Cold War, to understand why they're, you know, going in a different, in a much, much more closed, much more, you know, kind of single party, non-electoral, closed authoritarian direction.
And any outlook for any post-Hun Sen period, whenever that might arrive?
Well, they're already kind of working into it, right? So his son has been prime minister, what, since, you know, sometime 2023, I think it's about a year now. And and again, the monarchy is on board with it, it seems. And again, it seems like he's been able to lock things down and to do so pretty successfully. So, you know, I suspect you're going to see Cambodian civil society pushing for other things, pushing, you know, more economic gains, you know, because the party system at this point, you know, they don't really have have that outlet. So I think that's where the competitiveness is going to lie. So you'll see Cambodia, I think, you know, certainly being very close to China, but also trying not to entirely alienate the United States. So a la Indonesia, basically everybody in Southeast Asia, you know, they're not going to just rely on just one outside patron if they can avoid it. They're going to try to balance these things and have as many major wealthy and well-armed supporters as they possibly can in the international arena.
Yeah, they're really in a position now to play one power off the other, aren't they, with this increasing dichotomy between China on one hand and the U.S. and its allies on the other.
Yeah, I mean, Vietnam, I think, is the ultimate example of this. Cambodia probably isn't in quite as strong a position in Vietnam. Vietnam, of course, with its history of anti-Chinese sentiment, you know, I think Vietnam, you could really see balancing the two. I don't think Cambodia will ever really balance China and the United States, but I mean, China is going to clearly be the more important partner there. But keeping the United States involved, keeping the international community more generally involved, and again, just not becoming, you know, just a pure client state of China is going to be a goal for the CPP regime for sure. And I think the prospects are there for it. And you know, again, U.S.-China rivalry basically makes it such that, you know, again, like a la during the Cold War, I think that, you know, countries will be able to say, well, you don't want us to only work with China, do you? So turn a blind eye to, you know, to things that are going on. So I think that's a familiar history. We're back in it.
Yeah. It also sort of assumes that there's a U.S. administration that wants to engage, but that's a subject for another
very true
podcast.
For a few months from now, yes, we have a few months to go before we jump off that bridge when we come to it.
Yeah.
Yes,
plenty of other people talking about that. They don't need me to weigh in, I don't think so. What's the book
nor,
that?
Nor I. Yeah.
Your the book on Cambodia.
No. So the book is it was written with Joseph Wong. Came out in 2022. It's called From Development to Democracy. And so what it does is it basically argues that the way that democracy has come about in what we call developmental Asia, starting with Japan, South Korea, Taiwan, and then moving through the region, democracy doesn't come when weak regimes collapse. It comes when stronger dictatorships concede reforms and they continue to do well in elections and basically thrive under democracy. And so that's basically true of, Golkar in Indonesia. And the argument is that Cambodia, Malaysia, and Hong Kong are the three cases where there was sort of an apex of power where, all three of these electoral authoritarian regimes were very popular. And we're in a position where if they had done what, say, Indonesia did or what South Korea did and actually opened up the system, you could expect to keep winning elections. But that window was missed, and it got to the point where basically the CPP was losing the popular vote, and then they just, they just turned their claws around and, basically cracked down because they knew if things were free and fair, they were likely to lose. So again, Cambodia, Malaysia, Hong Kong were the three cases that kind of missed their windows. To actually reform when they were still in a strong position. So that's where Cambodia fits into that that conversation.
Okay, great. Okay, well, thank you so much for joining us, and I appreciate your time. And there's going to be plenty to watch and talk about in the future.
No doubt.
So looking forward to that too.
Thanks a lot, Kevin. Sorry Aaron couldn't be with us, but always a pleasure to talk with you.
Yeah, you too. All right. Thank you, Dan.
Take care.
And that's the pod. Our editor is Stephen Handogu. Music by Blue Dot Sessions. For a 2-week trial of Reformasi Weekly newsletter, go to reformasi.info. I'm Aaron Cook, and I'll see you again next week.